Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, your host and CEO of Bregman Partners. This podcast is part of my mission to help you get massive traction on the things that matter most. With me today is Tara Moore. The book is Playing Big, Practical Wisdom for Women Who Want to Speak Up, Create, and Lead. Tara is the founder of the acclaimed Global Playing Big Leadership Program for Women, and the book is excellent, and I highly suggest that you pick a copy up, whether you are a man or a woman. And so I'm going to start with this beef that I have with you, which is, it's actually a beef that I have with myself, to be honest, which is that I got the book in the mail. I guess somebody sent me the book. It might have been, you know, your PR or the publisher. And I looked at it, and this is embarrassing, but I'm just going to admit to it because I think this is important. I looked to it, and it goes, Tara Moore, Playing Big, Practical Wisdom for Women. And I turned to my wife, Eleanor, and I said, hey, Eleanor, you should read this book. It's for women, you know, to, you know, speak up and create and lead. And then I sort of said, you know, let me know, and I'll look at it after you. But I got persuaded by the title, just looking at it and going, okay, this is for women and I'm a man. And so like, I'm going to go give it to, you know, my closest woman and have her read it. And she loved it. And then I delayed a little bit more and then finally read it. And I found so much value for me in it. I found it so profound. So I completely understand why it would make sense and why this is specifically directed to women. But I just kind of want to admit to my own bypass of the book originally and so happy that I didn't in the end, and that I think this is practical wisdom for men who want to speak up, create, and lead as well.
Yes. Well, thank you for sharing that. I love that. And now, you know, it's funny, when the book came out, people would send us like photos if they snapped a guy reading it on the subway in his business suit, or, you know, we were hearing from a lot of men, and it became clear to me that I wrote the book with that focus because of a passion for bringing women's voices forward, but not because the tools and concepts are only relevant to women. And it's been really heartening, actually, to see as the book makes its way into the world, people get that. They get that it's relevant to everyone. So we, you know, are doing corporate trainings now that are co-ed, and a company that I just did an event at bought the book. I thought it was very courageous. They bought the book for all of their college interns, probably 75% of whom were male, because it was a tech company. And I thought that was pretty cool that they were just going to hand them all a book with women in the subtitle and say, we trust this is relevant for you for your own career, and because you'll be managing and working with and, you know, being colleagues with women. And so some of the things that are gender specific, I think, are great for men to have awareness raised about too.
I think that's exactly right. That I was going to say it, and you've just said it, that it's as important. I find it's as important for me personally as a man to use some of these techniques. And I'll point to a couple of things that really hit home for me, but also as a, you know, as someone who runs a business, who women work for Bregman Partners, and I'm working with clients, and I have daughters, and right. Like, I think, you know, we're living in a world now in which this conversation has to happen. And so, and it's, and you, I think, articulate it really skillfully and beautifully. So thank you.
Thank you.
I didn't bypass it. I would love for you to start with the story you have in the book about the producer. And you start out with the story because I think you create a balance between kind of, you know, victim and actor that I think is really, really important. So can you share that story?
Sure. Well, this is a story of years ago. I was doing a television segment about some of the ideas I talk about in my work, and particularly some of the ways that women can use speech patterns or phrases in our writing that undermine how we come across. And so I was waiting in the green room about to go on with my segment. I was already feeling nervous because, you know, it's TV and it's 5 a.m. and I was surrounded by the cast of a reality television show who were loudly bantering with each other. And about 5 minutes before I was supposed to go on, and it was a live show, the producer came in and she said, okay, I just want to do, you know, they do the quick talking points rundown. And she said, here's what the anchor's going to say. The anchor's going to say, you know, women are only 12% of senior managers and 4% of Fortune, whatever, CEOs. And our next guest, Tara Sophia Moore, is here. And she says, women have no one to blame but themselves. Welcome, Tara. So you need to find your voice on the spot in a moment when, you know, you got 5 minutes, ready, nervous, thinking about my talking points. And so I just say to her, well, wait. That's not, you know, can we change that? No, we can't change it. It's too late. Well, what if we just said, you know, our next guest says there's something women can do about that. And she said, oh, let me go talk to the executive producer, came back and it was changed. But I thought it was such a great emblematic moment about the confusion that we have between the internal and the external barriers that we all face, but specifically that women face to their own empowerment. And that we tend to think of those things as really separate, like, oh, there's bias and there's discrimination. And then there's these habits or behavior patterns that women do to themselves and they should go fix them and it's nobody else's problem. Instead of seeing the connection, right? That whatever those undermining patterns are that we might have, we have them in response to how we've been socialized or to external barriers. And then some of those can also, you know, enhance or cause us to not enhance some of those external barriers or cause us to not be able to effectively navigate around them or move beyond them.
Yeah. And this idea that you could not be necessarily the cause of your challenge, and at the same time, you can also be responsible for changing how it impacts you.
And how else could you be at this transitional historical moment, right? Like knowing what history is for women, what our mothers and grandmothers and great-grandmothers' lives and opportunities were like, therefore what we were taught, therefore what we saw about what women's lives could be, and then now having a set of pretty different opportunities, what else can we do except look at what the legacy of that history is and think about how we want to unlearn some things and learn some new things.
It's great. Talk to us, if you would, about the sort of inner critic and the inner mentor, which is a central piece of the book and I think important.
Yes. Well, I think one of the most important things we all need to do is understand the multiplicity of voices inside ourselves and really stop thinking of ourselves as just, there's just me. Nope, there's different parts of you. There's your inner wisdom. There's your voice of self-doubt. There's the voice of fear. And the more that the neuroscience is able to really help us understand our brains, the more the science is also showing we're not one holistic self with an executive function that controls everything else. There's a lot of competing parts of us that evolved at different points in human evolution, and they're often conflicting. So along those lines, in the Playing Big model, we look at one, the inner critic, which is that voice of self-doubt that we all have, and then two, something called the inner mentor. So the inner critic, for, you know, conventionally what people tend to think is, I'm not that confident. I need to become more confident. I can really beat up on myself, as if it's a personal problem. And it turns out this is a universal for men and women. We've all got this voice. It does tend to show up a little bit differently along some gender lines, but we've all got that voice. And we can come to look at it as not something we need to get over, but a fundamental part of us that is an expression of our safety instinct. So anytime we're going out of the comfort zone, anytime we're taking emotional risk, our safety instinct doesn't like that, tries to get us to go back in the comfort zone. And how is it going to do that? Well, one of the most powerful ways it can do that is by using that inner critic voice that says, you're about to make a fool of yourself. Who do you think you are? There's no way you're qualified for that. Better go home and get another PhD in that subject before you say anything about it, right? All those inner critic lines. So we want to come to expect that the inner critic's going to be there when we're stepping forward, and not try and overcome it or get rid of it, but learn to hear it without taking direction from it.
You know, it's interesting because as you say that about Inner Critic, I just read some research that I read at HBR, and it was looking at how the best CEOs differ from average ones. And what, you know, after a tremendous amount of research, what they came to is two traits that the CEOs are, the top CEOs are more likely to embrace appropriate risk, and they have a bias toward acting, right, and capitalizing on opportunities. And both of those things are traits that your inner critic will say, whoa, 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 hold on, right? Like, I don't know that you should take that risk. And, you know, maybe wait on taking the action. Talk to a few more people. So I think that, I mean, literally that research just came out, or I just saw it today, but it reflects on the, you know, while the inner critic is important, these are ways in which these voices might hold us back from being, you know, certainly in business, in the CEO role, the most successful.
Absolutely. And we know that the safety instinct in us, which is the root of the inner critic, the safety instinct is not looking out for probable danger. It's not looking out for clear evidence of danger. It is looking out for any possible danger, because it's has an evolutionary basis of, if you think that that berry might be poisonous, if you think there might be a predator on the horizon, avoid it. That's how you're going to survive. So it's, you know, it very, very overreactive and very conservative.
It's a survival instinct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when it's applied to things that aren't really about life and death survival in that overreactive way, it misleads us a lot of the time. And we can't see things that are low risk, that are medium risk. Everything is, you know, if it's a risk, don't go there.
So how do we manage that? Meaning, how do we distinguish between the advice that our inner critic is giving us that actually should be listened to and the advice that's actually just holding us back?
Yeah. Well, I would say there's no advice our inner critic is giving us that we should listen to. There's critical thinking that can be helpful. There's realistic thinking that can be helpful. And in the book, I talk about how do you distinguish realistic thinking from inner critic. And sometimes you can tell just by the tone of the voice. So realistic thinking tends to be linear, meaning forward moving. It'll take you, oh, if this, then that, and what can we do about that? And let's brainstorm. Inner critic tends to really loop. Inner critic tends to talk in a very chattering, anxious tone. Realistic thinking is more curious and generative. So you can start to distinguish. And then when you're hearing your inner critic, it's really a mindfulness practice to say, oh, I know what that is now. I've spent some time studying what the inner critic is and what mine tends to say. Okay, I'm hearing my inner critic right now. And now I get to make a choice. Do I want to take direction from that part of me, or do I want to take direction from my mission, my values, my desire to serve, my instinct toward growth, all of those things? And the inner mentor, which you referred to, is also a really great way, I think, for me, from what I've seen and how it's impacted so many people. It's one of the most powerful and easy ways to move beyond the inner critic, because it really replaces, in a way, the inner critic voice in very important moments. And the inner mentor, so, you know, in the business world, so much talk about mentoring, and especially in the women's leadership conversation, there's a whole other layer worship, in a way, of the panacea of mentoring, which has not lived up to its promise. And the idea with the inner mentor is that through a guided visualization that we do in the book, you meet an older, wiser version of yourself about 30 years in the future. And when people do this through that kind of right brain vehicle and in a very relaxed state, they're often very surprised and moved by who shows up. This is not your worries of how you're going to look when you're 30 and will you have achieved this and will this partner be still. It's almost like an image of your essential self or your elder self, elder in the kind of most grace-filled way, shows up. And then you can relate to that figure like a mentor and consult with them, check in with them, ask how they would handle any day-to-day situation in your life. And the answers are really there for people. And it's very powerful.
reminds me to do that again. I did it actually as I was reading through the book, and I came up with this, of course, very handsome and you know, I aged very beautifully. And I sort of imagined myself in this, you know, garden, but I couldn't figure out whether I was like on the sea or not on the sea. And I was, you know, relaxed, kind of a writer. But I struggled a little bit because I thought, huh, is this really what I'm going to look like, where I'm going to end up, what I'm going to be doing? Am I going to be this kind of a writer? It was like more fiction kind of, you know, it's like some fantasies that I have showed up in, in the future looking view of my mentor. And I found myself wondering, like, is this just my fantasy of what I would like to be? Or is this, you know, actually sort of my future me, but maybe be asking the wrong question.
Well, yeah, because so, it, you know, often the images that come up, first of all, there's a combination of literal and symbolic, right? So we would want to look at, okay, what are your associations with that garden? And what did it feel like for you? And what is that a metaphor for? And how can you bring more of that energy into your life right now? And then similarly, yeah, maybe you'll be writing fiction in 30 years, maybe not, but that longing, what you're calling a fantasy, I would be like, fantasy sounds a little demeaning to that. You know, that sounds like something, there's something there that's real that wants to come forward. So what is that? And that could be getting more into your creativity. That could be spending a couple hours a week writing fiction now, right? So it's not a literal prediction of the future. It's really almost like dream imagery, expression of your more authentic self. And so then the question becomes, how do I move towards that? Not how do I arrive at it? It's like a North Star, you know? So in whatever choices you're making today, how would that self choose, right?
And also, the question that comes to me is, how do I know to trust it? Like, I'm going to take some risks to move in that direction. How do I know to trust it?
Well, what would be a risk you would take?
I would put off doing some current work that I think would bring me, you know, that would kind of move me forward currently in the mission and the work that I'm doing. And I would spend time, you know, doing some stuff that probably my inner critic would say is not a very good use of my time.
Got it. And what is it you have to trust that step is going to be what or
bring
what?
That's a great question, Tara. So for me, what immediately comes up to it is that it would be successful. That I would like write some fiction.
What
would
your mentor say about that concern?
What my mentor says about that concern is, I'll just tell you what immediately comes up to me is that there, first of all, if you don't do it, there's no way it could be successful. And second of all, like the first few times that you do it, I could pretty much guarantee you that it won't be successful. You know, like it's, if you're doing it in order to be successful, certainly the first time out, then you're going to be disappointed because you can't. And if you don't do it for fear of it not being successful, then you'll never really get to that point. And if it is something that you long for, and I want to talk about the point that you made, which is so valid and so right that I demean it by saying fantasy, that if you don't pursue the things that you long for, that's exactly what you're going to end up regretting, whether it's successful or not.
So for your inner mentor, this is really not about, right, whatever this definition of success is that you're holding, there's something more there, right? And probably the more you delve into that conversation, the more sense you can get from your inner mentor of what it is about and what the why really is for you.
Right.
But I also think, you know, this is a beautiful illustration of, you open by talking about the relevance for men. You know, one of the big things I see is that for women, there's so much inner critic around, like, am I legitimate? Who do I think I am? Do I know enough? Like, that's all our baggage. For men, there's this whole other set of challenges, which is, how do I trust the callings in me when I'm in a society that still defines so often men's worth by a kind of external success, earning power, right? All that stuff. And that's a whole other load of inner critic messages, and in a different set of challenges around trusting what comes from within.
Right. That's absolutely true. And I can immediately come to, you know, I actually have these responsibilities that if I'm not successful enough, I'm not, you know, and my inner critic can be very, very practical, right? Because there's really practical concerns around, and I can also, and this is, I guess, how you know it's an inner critic versus realistic, which is very easy for me to follow the link to then being homeless on the street, you know, like you know, step by step by step by step, making all of these poor decisions.
And your inner critic would love to convince you it's either or, when really, you know, if you are to actually go sit with your inner mentor and say, how do I honor this creative part of myself and fulfill my, you know, and be responsible and fulfill my financial responsibilities, I can promise you, your inner mentor is not going to say, tough, you got to choose, you know, it's one or the other. Your inner mentor is going to, you can tell me what your inner mentor would say, but it's, whenever we're hearing that inner, you know, that either or between callings and financial viability, I that to me is, you know, it has now so consistently appeared. It's like a number one sabotage tool of the inner critic, because it's a way of saying, you know, don't go there. Don't go into the scary territory of listening to your voice. Don't try something new. Don't be a beginner. Don't listen to these callings. Don't stand out, because all of this will be lost if you do. And it's not true. It's not true. I mean, you know, find me a person who can't find 30 minutes in their week to give a calling a little breathing room.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Hal Hirschfield, I don't know if you know the name or if you know him. He's a researcher. I'm going to say the wrong university, so I'm not going to say the university because I just can't remember. But I've written some about this, and he's done research on future you, this idea of like your future self. And he's done these brain scan images where he has you think about, for example, yourself now. And then he has you think about a stranger, a complete stranger, like name someone that comes to mind. Name anybody.
Complete stranger?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean like a famous person.
Oh, like a famous person.
Yeah, right. You could just name a complete
LeBron James.
LeBron James. So James, you're right. Into LeBron James. So you could picture, you know, you should think of yourself. Then you think of LeBron James. And then you think of yourself in 30 years, your future self, right? Mm-hmm. And the part of your brain that lights up when you're thinking about yourself is different than the part of the brain that lights up when you're thinking about LeBron James. And the part of your brain that lights up when you're thinking about yourself in the future is the same as the LeBron James part, not the same as the you part. So when you're thinking about yourself, you see yourself as a stranger. Like you basically, your brain sees yourself in the future. And he's doing this research around how do you get people to save, right? For their IRAs or their, you know, retirement, when they really see themselves in the future as a complete stranger. It's much harder to get them to save. And so he's doing that research. But we talked a lot about, you know, how you begin to connect yourself to your future self and really understand that. And you're suggesting something I think very beautiful, which is that you could actually see your future self as a little bit of a stranger. That's okay, right? And let that stranger give you a little bit of advice and follow that advice. So I think that you're suggesting something around this research that I think works very well.
It's very interesting. That's very interesting around the research. And I would say, you know, most people, when they encounter their inner mentor, there's some combination of surprise and otherness and deep familiarity. Like, oh yeah, you know, like I know that. That's all the parts of me that I left behind, you know, that I, or, oh, you know, some, there is a resonance. It's interesting.
That's great. So I don't want to end without talking about some of these communication moves that help us come across more powerfully, because that's what I really saw. When I looked through your list, and I've actually even heard myself say it here when I say, you know, I think, blah, 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 that I fall into this trap, and I see people falling into this trap all the time. And it almost feels aggressive to not use some of them, because it feels like I'm imposing my view on people as opposed to stepping back and using words like just or actually or I think. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit, first of all, you could share some of those words or some of those techniques, or not techniques, some of those linguistic traps that we fall into that reduce our power in situations. And how do we manage ourselves in those moments where we may not want to come across too forcefully, but at the same time, we don't want to undercut our own power?
Right, right. Yeah, so there are a number of them, as you mentioned, inserting a lot of just, I just think, I just have a question. Actually, I actually disagree is a really common one for women, which of course connotes like we should be surprised that you have an opinion or that you're disagreeing. I'm not an expert in this, but a very common one is after saying something, often after saying something that takes a few sentences to explain, asking, did that make sense? Does that make sense? Which has a good intention to connect with the listener, but the way it's expressing that intention is, you know, am I coherent or am I crazy kind of thing? I almost think, I kind of think, all of these things. So the research shows those speech patterns are more common for people who have lower status in society. So there is a race and gender component there. And also that they are read differently when conflated with a stereotype. So for women, for people of color, they're more likely to have a dramatic effect in a negative way, whereas for someone in a high status group in our society, it might just soften what they sound, how they sound.
Right, and I've thought about that. So as I hear myself saying it, I think I'm white, I'm male, I'm Jewish, so maybe that like brings me, you know, brings me off of that super high status. But it's still, you know, I'm white, I'm male, I'm in a high status position. I'm somewhat known in the world. And so all of that already, pushes up my authority where maybe using some of these same, linguistic, measures that it actually allows me to connect with people in a way that I might otherwise seem or feel standoffish or overpowering. And so I could see why this might be a section of the book where men should use some of these things and women should not use some of these things. So I wanted you to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. And so women tend to use them because we've just absorbed it by habit because we hear other women using it, or we know we are much more likely to be told we're too aggressive, we're abrasive, right? That's a word that almost only gets used for women. It gets often used in women's performance reviews. We're being too direct. And so we do these things to tone it down so we can be heard and we'll still be seen as likable. The problem is it also tends to then undermine how competent people perceive us to be. So what we can try and do is let go of those diminishing habits, the kinds of things I was just referring to. But not only do that, we also then need to be conscious of warmth. Because for better or worse, if women don't communicate in a way that conveys warmth, right? And we just went through this election, which we could say a million things about, but one of them was that, you know, there was a huge discussion about how much Hillary should smile and trying to find the perfect balance. That's exactly that, right? Like, how is she communicating warmth so that people can also receive the competence that's coming across and the knowledge that's coming across. So for women, we want to let go of those diminishing, the doesn't make sense, the just, the actually, but then also think about how do I convey warmth? And that can happen through facial expressions, that can happen through connecting with the listener, expressing a personal interest. Instead of does this make sense, it's I really am looking forward to your thoughts. What do you think? Kind of thing. So the bid for connection is still there. The expression of warmth that we kind of demand of women is still there, but not in a way that diminishes us.
It's great. Let me ask you one final question, which I should never promise because this conversation is really interesting and I'm going to want to continue it, but I also want to keep to time. You are bringing this into organizations. There's a very human side and element to your message and also to you that comes forth. You know, you were just talking about warmth and competence, which is, you know, again, the research says from a credibility standpoint, it's this combination. You have both warmth and competence. And it's, I think there's something useful to learn about what you've learned about bringing this kind of a message into corporations that can be somewhat results oriented and hard nosed. And, you know, I think there's much more openness for this now than there was probably 20 years ago. But I also think there's something to learn from saying, you know, How do you share this in a way that brings people in and on board and doesn't threaten people and also like allows for what I'm going to call feminine energy, you know, into the conversation, which is often very much driven by male energy, whether it's women or men. It's often, you know, the corporate world is, there's like a lot of male energy into it, and you're bringing this feminine energy into it. And I'm wondering what you've learned from this or what you might be able to teach us.
Well, you know, it's fun for me because I spent a lot of my life feeling like I had one foot in each of two worlds. I grew up in a home where spirituality and psychology, you know, were everyday topics. And so many of those ideas I was raised on, you know, from age five, dream analysis and unconscious motivation, Jungian archetypes. But I was also expected to excel in school. And school was a totally different world, you know, with a completely different set of values and norms. And so that often felt like a real split for me. And so now that I, you know, can go into companies with my left brain, with an MBA, with analytics about the impact of this training, and bring in some concepts that are softer and an energy that's softer that people are just starving for, you know, in my experience, it's a beautiful, like this thing that people used to tell me these two things had nothing to do with each other. It's nice to see people being like, oh, that's just what we need. So, you know, I have found that actually my assumptions about what's wanted in the corporate world are usually wrong and stereotypical. And I have, you know, done trainings, for example, with, you know, conservative financial institutions where I thought, of course, we're not going to touch inner mentor. You know, I'm going to do work. We're going to do this module and this module. And 3 days before, they're like, why isn't inner mentor in this agenda? And doing the inner mentor visualization with hundreds of people who work in a financial institution in their corporate office, and having the room be so silent a pin could drop and have people weeping and love it. And me being surprised, like that was my limiting vision. And they're just so thankful to have the opportunity. So, you know, I've had to learn a lot of the things I thought would be difficult to bring are actually people are just so, so starving for it.
Right. It's great. Tara Moore, the book is Playing Big, Practical Wisdom for Women Who Want to Speak Up, Create, and Lead. The book itself was a high bar for this conversation, and you have exceeded it. It's such a pleasure to have this conversation with you, Tara. Thank you for being on the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks everyone for listening.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.